My name is Clancy Emmisland. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight. I've been sober a lot of years, 42 years. I've traveled a lot. I've had the opportunity to speak all over the world one time or another. And I had a first tonight, and it kind of touched my heart. This is the first time in all the years I've been sober where I've been called upon to speak an hour and a half after the meeting starts. So we'll buzz right through this so we can get back to the important things like getting down to the IHOP. I hated to spoil the fun here by discussing AA. But I'm, that's because I'm kind of getting kind of old and crotchety. We had a little difficult time. I knew it was a bad night when we couldn't land in Portland this afternoon. The plane almost landed and then took off again, because the wind was blowing so hard, and I knew there were... All of us in the plane cried and said our prayers and sang and vowed to do better. As soon as we landed, that all went away again. You know. I want to thank Kimberly for picking me up and being very kind. She brought her son Brendan and her pigeon and her little baby, who got a little sick, vomited 3 or 4 times, but she's a cute little girl. And got to the hotel, and they had my room in somebody else's name, and they couldn't find any reservation. And it was cold and sleeting and cold. I felt tired. And I got up to the point of tired, hungry, angry. Thank God I wasn't lonely. When you're a schizophrenic, you never really are lonely. I guess when I went to the nut house in the 1950s, they diagnosed me as an intense schizophrenic. And I wish I'd lived now. I could have been a bipolar or a tripolar, or maybe seeing Santa Claus go by, I could have been a North Polar. But I've been old a long time. In fact, I must say, first time I came up to Portland to speak was 30-some years ago, I guess. A long time ago. And now I'm old. I'm over the hill. I was thinking about that. 3 years ago, I turned 70. And my doctor had me start taking iron tablets. I guess you do that for your blood when you get older. And I've been taking them. I feel all right. I still play a little softball, a little volleyball. Still in pretty good shape. But a couple of months ago, I tried an experiment. I've been reading about it in the magazine. I shouldn't have done it, I suppose. But I tried my first Viagra. And I didn't know that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. I'm sorry. It's not as bad as some old guy in our group who's even older than I am, who says, I take an eighth of a Viagra every morning. And I said, what the hell do you do that for? He says, just so I won't pee on my shoes. I want to thank Richard and the committee for inviting me up here. It's been a pleasure to be here. And my problem is this. I'm kind of a control addict. No, I can't read his writing either. Let me change the thrust of the meeting here. Just let me introduce something before we go any further. I used to drink alcohol. And I drank it a long time, and I enjoyed it very much for a long time. And it was very good for me. Tonight when we came to the hotel, got out of the airport, it was a cold rain falling. And every time there's a cold rain falling this time of the year, I hearken back to an autumn cold rain. And I found myself in a situation that a person of my background and education and ability cannot be in. Two big guys are throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. I try to explain to you, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know. When I stood outside that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning, dark, still dark, and I couldn't believe this was happening to me. I remember thinking, this must be a dream. Any minute my wife's going to shake me and say, Clancy, you've kicked off all your covers. No wonder you're cold. Get up and go to work. But it wasn't that. And I had a terrible feeling that I could not identify. I identified it since then by listening to other people talk about it. But, and I'm sure it's happened to people in this room, where you get in a situation where there is no friendly direction. There's no place to go back to. They don't want you back wherever you came from. There's no friendly direction. And I stood there just in the shock. And if some old God came up to me that morning and said, hey, Clancy, you know, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your front teeth. A guy in the Phoenix jail kicked him out last week. And I knew that was true because my gums were bleeding, my lips were swollen. You've lost all your clothes. All you got left is what you got on. There's a torn suit, wet and dirty. You're an only child, and your mother's no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you up in Wisconsin because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions and work on your emotions to get some more loans that your stepfather would rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. Now, you've been going to AA off and on now for 10 years. And slipping. Why don't you, for God's sake, just go back one more time to AA and admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if some guy had come up to me and said that, I'd had to tell him, pal, you don't understand. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. God would make my life so much better. I'm not an alcoholic. I know there's something wrong with me. I've known that since I was a little boy. But it's become apparent to me as the years went by, there's something missing in me, and I don't know what it is. But I know that other people seem to recognize it, and they get close to me, they don't seem to like me as well. And I don't seem to fit into situations like other people do. And I don't seem to get along with people. I can't sustain relationships very long. I feel inadequate sometimes. Sometimes I feel superior. I just never feel like other people. And I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find out why this is. And I've read books, and I've traveled around. And when I was 15 years old, restless and irritable and discontent as a boy up in Wisconsin, the Second World War started, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. My mother had no idea where I was going. She thought I was up in Superior visiting my aunt. And I got to San Francisco, and a guy showed me how to lie my age to get some merchant marine papers. And I was on my way to the South Pacific. And on that ship, I had a terrible time at first because, you know, these were really tough guys. I was a small, little, dumb Norwegian Lutheran puke with pimply face. And as soon as I got on there, as soon as we left port, I knew I was in deep, I'd made a severe career error. But after about 2 or 3 days, I remember the first day because I was raised in very strict, unlike our first Al-Anon speaker. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, in a very, very strict church. Our dropouts become Catholic priests. I never saw many Catholics close up, but I heard about them. I'll tell you that. And these guys, I was in this room with these men, where I guess they turned out later to be the deck crew that I was attached to. All I knew is they were tough-looking guys, and I was a little, I could see there was a little tension in there, so I told him a couple jokes that I was used to go over good in study hall, and, that's stupid. Get your bunk. I got my bunk, and that ship was moving, and it was hot, and I was lonesome, and I wanted my mother, and I just felt so bad. And then these guys start talking, and I couldn't believe my ears. They were talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco the 3 days they'd been there. They'd been doing dirty, dirty things. Oh, man. And I suddenly realized, of course, they've all got black hair. These are these Catholics I've heard about. And I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were talking about doing it with people, if you can imagine that. It was a terrible time. And I eventually found a little niche. I found a little niche on that ship that people like me find, and that's you become the ship fool, you know. Hey, kid, get out of the engine room. Tell me you need left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And these guys used to sit out every afternoon after their watch and drink whiskey. They always thought we were supposed to do it, but nobody has ever said anything. And one day, a guy turned to me and said, how about you, Junior? You think you're mad enough for a little snort? And he shoved that bottle in my face, and that was too much. I may be small and I may be stupid, but I am a Norwegian Lutheran. Now, just get ready to tell him, you get that bottle out of my face, you dirty guy. I promised my mother and grandmother I wouldn't drink whiskey. I wouldn't drink it anyway. His filthy, rotten stuff is the devil's work. How dare you stick that in my face? I was just about to tell him this. He says, why do you think you're man enough? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. I had my first drink out of the first bottle I was close to. And it burned my mouth and my stomach and my mouth and burned his shirt the last I saw of it. Get the bottle away, little son of a bitch. I still can remember that humiliation and embarrassment. I don't know any feelings in the world that are worse than public humiliation, public embarrassment. If I had a gun, I'd have shot those guys. But I had no gun. I couldn't hit them. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They would have thrown me overboard, I suppose. But I could have leaned over you. Yeah. Take that. Just give one in the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific when nobody was around, I was sneaking that guy's sea bag every day. I just hated that stuff. And I'd take a drink and I'd vomit it up and have to wipe it up so they didn't know about it. And this went on day after day because I wanted so desperately for these guys to think I was a man, accept me. And I had just... And we're coming into Pearl Harbor and they're still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was down there one more day before my 16th birthday. I remember it very well. I took a drink and it stayed down. And then I couldn't hardly breathe. And then all of a sudden something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I realized why people drink alcohol. It makes you feel significantly better. I didn't know that. Some people seem to realize that. You know, when you're growing up, you learn things in your teens. You never think about it. They just happen. Okay. I learned to smoke on that ship. Nobody in my family smoked. They all smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And one day I didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. I learned to curse. I learned to lust effectively, at least by eavesdropping. I've always envied people who had insights. I never had any insights. I mean, I heard a guy speak at an AA meeting a few years ago. He said, when I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and fruits to be savored in the coming years until I left that garden to come to this wonderful program and find you wonderful people. God, I wish I'd known that. All I ever learned is if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's what I learned. And I didn't become terrible. You know, I think about that sometimes. It's an amazing thing that you just grow up. And I didn't become a terrible drunk. I got drunk in Hawaii and Honolulu the next day. They took me down, bought me beer, and I got drunk, and they all laughed, and I thought it was great. And got back in the ship. I wasn't drunk again for a while. And I got a little older. I went on another ship to the Aleutians. In fact, on the way back to that ship, we lay off the Columbia River here because our captain had died of a heart attack. Remember that big storm blowing? They came out in a little launch and took his body off. We were all very excited. And I got to be, it's exciting to me, I'll tell you. When I was 17, I finally went in the Navy. At the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital in Pleasanton, California. They were being sewed up and they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests. So I got a very high mark and they gave me a high school diploma, honorary. I'm still a junior in high school. I went back to college after the war, went back to Wisconsin, went to college. And got involved in college, did quite well, won a couple of trophies for that university. Met this girl in college with coal black eyes and coal black hair. Just never saw anybody so exotic. And she won my heart. And after she won my heart, she dropped the bombshell. I'm a Catholic. And I struggled in the net, but she had me. And we got married, and my grandmother went into a depression for about 2 years. And now I'm out in the world. I became a sports writer. I've always been very much involved in sports writer. That's why I'm kind of glad to come here. Nobody's ever in the history of AA has ever been in this state when there were both universities were going to go to a bowl game before this. And Oregon and Oregon State both going to a bowl game is like the end of the world. But don't blame me. Blame the coach. Anyway. It's the best job ever. I always liked that job. But then my wife began making problems for me. She began manifesting the behavior of Catholic women. And I had no idea about it because nobody ever told me. And if you're a little Lutheran boy or Protestant boy and you're going with a good Catholic girl, watch your step. Because if you marry a good Catholic girl, you're about to have a big family, whether you plan on it or not. And I had started a second career as a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom. Just terrible. I remember saying to my wife, can't we use birth control? She said, no. And I think back now, I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. It's impossible for young people today to realize, but in those days, nobody ever talked about those things, ever, ever. I may have heard the word condom once, maybe in a Navy training film where they're talking about VD. And I would have paid attention because I was so hot for the girl that had VD. And what you see, the closest thing to birth control, you find bad guys would come along and say, I got a rubber. And even they wouldn't go in and buy them. You have to hire somebody depraved to do that. And even they would be ashamed. They'd go and say, hey, give me some cigarettes.
And some rubbers.
The world has changed a lot in the last 50 years, I'll tell you. Now, at least in the Rite Aid drugstore by my house in Los Angeles, these kids could say, hey, give me some condoms.
And some cigarettes.
And it's So I had to get better jobs. And I got into advertising, writing, public relations, worked a lot of places around the country. All the years I drank a lot and smoked a lot and lusted a lot and had a lot of, thought we were veterans and we just need this behavior. By the time 1949 came along, I was drinking too much and getting some problems. And somebody suggested I go to this new thing called AA. Which nobody ever heard of. And then he thought maybe he could help me cut down. So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And I don't know. All I remember, I'm sure I had the same feeling that some of the new people have about AA today. And just old people, gray-haired boobs in their 30s and 40s and 50s. And I don't know what they said, but it seemed to me they said things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door and they told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. Didn't take me long to realize I wasn't like them. I had emotional problems. And been out in the world, but from time to time I'd drink too much. I'd go back to AA in different cities because the heat would be on. I'd go back to AA. And you could go home and tell your wife anything. There wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. And that Lois Wilson caused a lot of problems. And I drank, and I seemed to be just a guy, a good writer, drink a lot, lose a job here, get another job there. I seemed to be just kind of holding my own, except, and I was doing fine, it seemed to me, except in a matter of a couple of weeks, I was working in Dallas at a big advertising agency called Tracy Locke. And within a matter of a few weeks, it seemed to me my whole life changed. I lost my job again for drinking. But this time I went on a little drunk after I lost my job, and I came home. My wife had left, taken all the children, had sold the furniture, so apparently she set it up in advance. My car was repossessed. I was evicted from the house, and I stood there with a suitcase full of clothes, and just the whole bottom fell out of everything. I couldn't believe it. And I knew I had to get out of Texas because I'm sure they'd have turned me in to go back to that state hospital I've been in. So they had a drive-away thing. Maybe they still do where you can. They want to move cars from place to place, and if you have a driver's license, you can drive. So I got a car to go to Los Angeles. I got as far as El Paso, and got drunk with a bunch of guys. Next day, I got as far as Phoenix, and I got drunk there and got in a beef on the street corner with a cop. That's one of the problems I have. I wish I didn't, but I have a tendency, when I drink just the right amount, I find it I'm compelled to counsel police officers. For their own good. And I've been in jail a lot, just overnight, but a lot. And I got in jail that night, and in the middle of the night I was sick, and I threw up in a guy's bunk accidentally and lay on the floor, and he came back from wherever he was and found me there, and he kicked my front teeth out as I lay in the ground. Damn, drunken bastard. And that was one of the few mornings I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis so long, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything and make trouble. The next morning I got out and I lost the car. I didn't know where the car was. I couldn't find that. And I thought I'd go over there. I've been off and on going to AA. It's different. I'll go over there and pretend to be a newcomer, see if I can get some dough. And I went to the AA club there, found it, and told some lady, I was a newcomer, I need some money for a 12-step house. And she gave me some money. I bought a bus ticket to Los Angeles, where I knew one guy, a big radio announcer, and I'd give him a start. And I went out to see him. Looked terrible, smelled terrible. So I'm in a terrible accident, Ted. And I'm waiting for my check. Can you help me out? And he gave me $100. Sure, Clancy. And I drank. And one night I wound up in an AA meeting, an AA club, and denounced them for being a bunch of boobs. And $100 went a little longer in 1958 than it does now. And I got ran out of the door, and I went back to see him. I said, Ted, my check hasn't come. He said, no, Clancy, I called Dallas. You haven't had any accident. You've turned into a bum. Stay away from the station. Stay away from here. Remember, he did something that I would have, when I think about it, it almost makes me shudder. It's one of the worst things that ever happened to me. He took a $5 bill and says, here, and he threw it in a mud puddle. That is the worst part. The worst part is I leaned over and picked it up. Thank you, Ted. And a couple of days later, two guys just threw me out of a skid row mission in a totally unfriendly town. And I never knew how to explain to people, it really isn't the alcohol. It's these feelings I have all the time. And alcohol, the first time I held a drink down on that ship, early in the Second World War, that was the first time I'd ever felt the way men looked. And I firmly believe the last time I took a drink, I was still drinking to feel the way men look. Now that isn't an alcohol problem. That's something wrong inside of me. But I stood in that street corner and nobody came up and talked to me. I was just sick. I remember where that damn club was, someplace called Wilshire and Fairfax. Wherever the hell is that? And I said, where's Wilshire and Fairfax? And I said, well, Wilshire doesn't come all the way down here. You have to go up the street to Hill Street, then go over Wilshire and go west until you find it. And I did that. And I walked and walked and walked and walked. And later on, I counted up a few years later in my car, 72 long blocks. That's a long walk when you're sick and desperate and just look and feel terrible. Gums bleeding. A woman asked me one time in New York, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so desperate? Of course, the answer is simple. That's the only time you can. You'd never do it. You would never do anything like that if you were desperate. Now, I got to this club, and they remembered me for being in there, and they weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them, and it was just terrible. And I hung around there that night. There was a meeting. I had about 4 pounds of cake and listened to some goof talking about gratitude and almost puked it up again. And after the meeting, I had no place to go. It was still raining. And then that's where you have to use your training to look like a newcomer every time you can. And I went up to the manager and said, I have no place to stay. I'm a new person. Is there someplace I could stay? He said, yeah, you're in luck, kid. He said, a guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. It's down in that tall grass, just dry, but you can sleep in it.
He said, you want me to sleep in an abandoned car?
Yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, thanks. I slept in that damn old abandoned car that night. I got up the next morning and went into the club. It was a Sunday morning. They were having a spiritual meeting. I had 4 more pounds of cake, and they talked about Jesus or somebody that was after me. And I hung around there, and that night there was another meeting. I slept in an abandoned car. It just kept raining. This went on for days. I remember thinking to myself, maybe I'm dead. Maybe my grandmother was right. You know, you marry a Catholic, and this is hell. Just hell. Cold and sick, and people advising you about AA every day. Jesus. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Because of all the times I ever got sober, and sometimes went to AA, that was the least time I ever wanted to stay sober. There's no reason to stay sober anymore, just to have pain. I've often wondered how I could stay sober, why I stayed. I used to wonder why I stayed sober. You might think if you're new, well, if you have a good enough reason, you can stay sober. Yeah, I guess that's true. In Texas, I had a good enough reason. I was in jail one night, again, overnight, and they came to me in the morning and said, while you were out drunk last night, your little son died and we couldn't find you. And it just about killed me because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and he was the idol of my eye, and he died. I remember that Sunday before the funeral, my brother-in-law and my father-in-law sat in the living room with me, and they were very kind. Nobody said an unkind word. Clancy, do you want some more coffee? Can I get you anything, Clancy? But you could just see in their eyes, you dirty, rotten bastard. You dirty, rotten bastard. The next day, when we buried him, I took surreptitiously put my hand in his casket. I said, John Immersland, this will never happen again in our family. Daddy will never drink again. I'll do this for you. And I felt so terrible, but at least he didn't die in vain. I went back to work in Texas, and I felt cleansed somehow. I felt so sad, but I felt cleansed. At least my son's death shouldn't be in vain. And I went to work, and it just every day I thought, boy, good, this is for you, John. And I had no idea that if you're of our type, no matter what the reason is, it's only a finite time. Before one night you go to sleep, and you get up, and in the middle of the night, some people come and visit you. Restlessness, irritability, resentment, discomfort. So I get up in the morning with that, and now it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time, baby, no matter what your reasons were. And I, as the days went by, all of a sudden I started getting more and more irritable. And that job I used to like, they're full of idiots up there in this town. I don't like this town. My daughters, who I was doing it for, they're noise bothering me. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Let Daddy alone. Jesus, we'll play tomorrow. I'm so sorry. And hate myself for being. But I knew if I could just have 2 or 3 drinks, determine I was significantly emotionally ill. As I say, it's intense schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies, and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Nothing on my commitment paper said alcohol or alcoholic. It's just that old sickness. After about 2 weeks, I escaped because I found a way out of there because I thought, what am I doing here? And they brought me back and gave me a whole autumn full of electric shock treatments. So you never don't run much after that for a long time. You know. What's your name, boy? I started to come out of it a little bit, and unfortunately, they saw on my record that I had directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. So they allowed me to, this time of year, I think about it, I directed the Christmas pageant at the Texas Insane Asylum in 1956. It wasn't a very complex production. The director's main job in rehearsals was trying to keep the 3 wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly could. Get back there, Lamar. We just want to worship her clientele. And I was there for some time. The next spring, they put in an alcoholic ward as an experiment in that hospital. And I'd been in and out of AA for 6-7 years by that time, so I could play them like a zither. And I eventually got out as a recovered alcoholic. Otherwise, I might still be there. I've often thought I'd like to go back to Texas sometime and find that psychiatrist that diagnosed me as some kind of a dual personality. He must be about 90 now. I can move him around pretty good, you know. You old quack, diagnosing me as a dual personality, you idiot. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. My problem has always been this group that gets together in my head every so often. Let's get out of here. Don't think we can. What do you think? I don't want to run for it. I used to hear people today say things like, I'm not sure the program's enough for me. I may need group therapy. I never have. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol for people like me. It reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch that bastard in the face? Now, I couldn't stay sober for the death of my son. Why would I stay sober living in an abandoned car in the back of an AA club? You know, they say there are no authorities in AA. That's not really true. You know who the authorities are? Speakers who come from a long ways away. They're speakers. When we have conventions in California, we get speakers from New York and Chicago and Texas. When they have conventions in New York, they have speakers from California and Chicago and Texas. Anyway, as long as you come from far enough away, you're an authority. I want to be humble about this. I don't want to push it too hard, but I'm kind of an authority in Toronto, Canada. I go there every February, and they have a day with Clancy I, if you can imagine what a thrill that must be. And it kind of tells you about me, doesn't it, though? The good speakers go south in the winter, north in the summer. In the summertime, I've been speaking in Texas and Florida. In the wintertime, I go to Toronto. Well, and Portland. World War II veteran. But in the morning, they have a question. I give a talk on something like the history of AA or the traditions or the concepts or something like that. In the afternoon, they have a question-answer meeting. And at night, I give a talk at a dinner. And I like the question-answer meetings because I seem to have a natural ability to weave a veritable oral tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. The answers get along, but they're beautiful. A few years ago, I was talking to a woman in the back. She said, Clancy, I have a question for you, and if you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers. I thought somebody ought to slap that bitch. She says, every year you tell us, you all the years you slipped and how terrible it was, and now you've been sober forever, it's just wonderful. But in a sentence or two, what happened? What was the difference? And I said, well, ma'am, you can't put that in a sentence or two. I mean, that's a kind of complex psychological, psychiatric, emotional, physical thing. I thought, I'm going to go back and pull her hair. What a goof. But I didn't do anything because I'm a nice guy. But she threw off my rhythm. It just ruined the whole afternoon for me. That night I was taking a shower before the meeting I was supposed to sneak out to this dinner, and an answer came. A one-sentence answer that would have answered her question. But I didn't like the answer. It was a crappy answer anyway. I like answers that have a little body, that have a little panache. A lot of the new people come up here and got chips tonight for 3 days and 10 days and 7 days. I'd like to have them leave the meeting tonight saying things like, did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night. Oh! Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon. Now, these answers mean nothing but to give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of was such a dreary little answer. This was the first time I ever found myself in such a situation of desperation that I did things in AA that I thought were stupid and beneath me and were demeaning. I would never do that. I don't mean big things like taking inventories. I mean little two-bit things. For example, and that was before styrofoam cups were invented. So all the meetings drank out of porcelain cups at the meeting, somebody had to wash the dishes. And, you know, after a while, the old-timers get sick of washing the dishes. They're looking for stooges to do it. Remember the guy said to me, "Are you? You in the front teeth without the front teeth there in the front row. You want to wash dishes tonight?" If I had any strength left, I would have said, "No. I don't want to wash dishes tonight or tomorrow night or any other night. Why don't you lick them off of your ugly tongue, you old bastard?" But I found I was so weak, I found myself saying, Another night says, "You want to stay a little later and mop the floors? How about coming early tomorrow night and set up the chairs?" And I stayed sober for a few days and people got to know me a little bit and the guys started buying me soft food to eat from time to time. And I stayed sober. You know, seriously, I was just sleeping in an abandoned car, going to the meeting, signing a rabbit club, having people warn people against me. And if you're new, if you stay sober a little while, something else happens. Then always some fanatics or something like, "Time you get a sponsor! You got a sponsor?" And I'd had a number of sponsors over the year. Every time I got sober, I got a sponsor. I tried to somebody rather distinctive, gave me a little juice, an editor of a newspaper one time, a doctor. I like sponsors, give a little, just stay away from them, because no matter how nice they seem, they always want to stick their nose in your business. They're really, but on the balance, you're all right. And I better get a sponsor. This guy used to come into the club all the time. He's a movie actor, a character actor. He was a star, but he always played loving roles. He gave people money and helped them. And I thought, that's my new sponsor. I'm going to get some money from him. I said, "Bob, would you be my sponsor?" "Sure, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you." "Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis." They like to hear that. I've looked back many times and thought, that guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because they were totally foreign to his nature. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just... I felt like Quasimodo. "Look, Bob, I'm ringing the bell." I mean, he wasn't, you know, he had no kindness. I said, "Bob, I'm living in an abandoned car and I'm sick and cold, Bob, and not eating. What am I going to do?" He said, "Get a job." I said, "Get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how so bad I look. Look how terrible I look." "I said, get a terrible job." I got some terrible jobs, you old fool. And I stayed sober little by little, and I did stupid things. And I've looked back many times and thought, why would I take that crap from that guy? Because my stock in trade was this: I don't take crap from anybody. I've quit big jobs, making more money than most people ever made, because somebody gave me too much crap. "You want to give me that crap? Get yourself another boy. I'm not going to take it," and walk out. I don't know how many nights in bars, people would hear me talking a lot and say, "You don't seem like you're so much. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Why don't you try me?" And I get knocked on my can a lot. But they know I'm tough. You know something funny? After I was sober a while, I look back and think, why did I have to be that tough all the time? It took me a long time to realize it. In fact, I heard about it in the guy's inventory I was listening to. And that's it. Because all my life, I secretly knew I was a weakling. And I hate it. I detest being a weakling inside of me. And no one is ever going to find out on the outside, I'll tell you. I'm tough and I'm slick and I'm hip and I'm cool. And then I just... So I got to do whatever's necessary. And the irony of AA is this: if you can stay here long enough and do these things over a period of time, you know one of the great results is you eventually become strong, like you always wanted to be. And then the other irony is this: once you become strong, then you can afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. But why would I take this crap from this guy? It took me a long time to understand that too. But I guess in my desperation, he wasn't always mean to me. He talked to me nicely sometimes. He'd sit down, he'd take me to meetings, he'd talk to me, and some of it filtered through. And I remember getting just a glimmer. My God, this guy seems to know something of how I feel. And I had never felt that anybody knew exactly how I felt. A lot of people gave me advice, information, but this guy seemed to know how I feel a little bit. And I couldn't, like a girl falling in love. My God, he knows how I feel. And I did things to impress him that I wouldn't do for my father or for baby Jesus. I wanted him to like me because he knew how I felt. I'll tell you what it's like. It's like being, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room have this feeling, you can be amongst a lot of people, but it's like you're in the middle of the cliff, and you can't get off. There's a big chasm on all sides of you. And that first identification is like a rope across the chasm. Why? And if you hang around little by little, that rope becomes a little rope walk, and one day it becomes a little road, and eventually it becomes an 8-lane superhighway. Forget there ever was a chasm there. But it all gets back to that first rope, and that's identification. And that is why it is so important. That's why they always stress here, you must be an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because they're better or worse than anybody else, but without that, there's no identification. You can be an alcoholic and an addict, a compulsive eater, gambler, whatever you want to be, but you must be an alcoholic, because that's what makes this work. There's only been two organizations in the history of the treatment of alcoholism in the last 5,000 years that ever had any success. One is AA, of course. One was the Washingtonians from 1840 to 1845. The same type of thing AA was. And they wound up with 100,000 sober drunkards in America. And then they thought, well, if we could help drunkards, we'd be able to help all sorts of people. So they stopped helping drunkards, began helping other people. And by 1848, they were extinct. With very few exceptions, they all died on the street. Very few people ever heard of the Washingtonians. But the most successful alcoholic treatment in the history of the world. And it became extinct. After 10 years in Alcoholics, and when Alcoholics Anonymous has been going 10 years and his car didn't come apart, and Bill Wilson read about the Washingtonians for the first time and read about what was going on in AA, and he sat down and wrote the traditions. The traditions just didn't happen. It didn't come out of the book one day. Thousands of alcoholics died in order to get those traditions written. And they weren't written in the way we read them tonight. A charming young lady read them. But they were written in the long form. Sometimes read the traditions in the back, right on the opposite of the short form, in the back of the book. In our meeting in Los Angeles, we consider them so important. We read them once a month instead of the short form. But little by little, this identification, and I began to do things. I got little jobs, and people let me sleep on their sofas, and the thing was fine until I was about 6 months sober, and I'd gotten into beef with the guy who I was staying with. I was temporarily going back sleeping in that abandoned car. And the guy got me a job at a dishwasher at a Haiti delicatessen. I got fired off that after the second day, because my mouth was mouthing off. And I said, at the 6 months, I might as well be dead to be this way. This is living like an animal. And I decided to kill myself. I'm going to walk to the ocean and just walk in and forget it. And I couldn't find the ocean. Just bad luck. And I thought, well, I'll call up my sponsor. But I hated to tell him I got fired because he hated to hear bad news. I thought, well, I used to be an award-winning writer. I'll tell him a story that is so sad and so beautiful that his rotten, cold heart will melt and he'll come down and help me. I said, Bob, this is Clancy. He said, why aren't you working? I said, Bob, let me explain something to you. You know, I've lost my family and my home and my career. You know that. That's all right. I'm used to that. But there's something you don't know, Bob. You all said AA would take me in and love me, but AA doesn't take me in and love me. When you're not there, sometimes when you're there, people treat me all right. When you're not there, people will not, they will call on, they call on me once in a meeting, never call on me again. People, I sit down at a table in the club, and sometimes they get up and go to a different table, and people warn their newcomers to stay away from me because I'm a loser, and I'm terrible. And no one seems to like me. Old-timers say, stay away from that bum. And it suddenly struck me, this is all true. And I burst into tears. Bob, what am I going to do? Why don't you write your inventory the way I told you? And I just told him the week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What are you going to say? Cut, reshoot that light? That's nonsense. But I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I said, Bob, I know you mean well, But in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world. And my God, I'm so full of remorse and regret and pain. I can't go through that again. In my judgment, I need something deeper and more thorough, cleansing. And he explained that to me. He says, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. And I came out of that phone booth and I turned left. Good thing I didn't turn right. I'd have been in that ocean in three steps. So I got to the club and said, Calvin, give me some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. And he gave me a pad of paper and I wrote for 2 hours. I put down things I wouldn't have breathed to a soul. Wouldn't tell anybody. Somebody said, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. You know. And I wrote this terrible thing. I got done and I felt a little better. At least I proved that didn't help. And I jammed it under the seat of my car. And a couple of nights later, he came by and said, okay, hop in the car. We'll take your fifth step. Hi, Bob, I'm not ready for that. Oh, shut up, he explained. He wanted to give me a ride from Santa Monica to Oxnard, gave me a flashlight, and I read it. And it read even worse than I remember, just dirty, filthy, nasty. I got near, I said, he'll make me walk back from Oxnard. That's 40 miles. I said, well, that's all, Bob. He said, are you done now? I said, yeah. He leaned over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. I said, I thought it was. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side, with some other little pukes over there with their flashlight. Let me explain this part before I read it. I'll tell you something funny. The funny thing is this. I have come to believe that all good inventories are exactly the same. Doesn't that sound strange? Because they're all over the lot. But they all contain certain elements. Lack of self-worth, fear, anger, a great deal of resentment, and occasional lashing out at the world to punish them for hurting me. And it varies. I mean, 1 week, a few years ago, I listened to a woman whose father had been one of the most famous men in the 20th century. And a couple of nights later, a guy who out of Washington State Penitentiary, Walla Walla, didn't even know who his father was. And their inventories were the same. She lived in a penthouse, he lived in a 12-step house. Same thing. It's that way, and if you're kind of new, you got to remember that. That's the way it is. The things that make us similar in AA, you can't see and you feel. You can't tell by looking at people. They're down deep. It takes a while to get to them. As I've said, it's that way all over. I mentioned earlier that I've done... talked a lot. I've been active a long time, all these years. And so the last few years I've had a chance to be asked to do something that most of you haven't had a chance to do yet. The last few years I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and London, and Belfast, and Dublin, and Oslo, and Paris, and Australia. Earlier this year I toured Australia for a week, and New Zealand, and all over Canada, and Central America. You'd think you'd find exotic AA in these places. But except for the accents, you hear the same emotions you hear in your local meetings. Always the same. Some people have accepted it and doing well, some people not accepting it. Every group in the world seems to boil down to this. In every group, there's a group of people who have come here feeling as bad as you ever felt or I ever felt. And they've been allowed themselves to be guided, or forced, directed into taking actions they didn't really believe in. And as a result of that, their perceptions changed and they started feeling better. And you see them in meetings on a continuing basis. And in every group, there's a few bunch of people who will not or cannot take these actions. And they rebel and they ridicule and criticize the people who do. And they make fun of them and behind their mouth. And in every group, there's a group of new people. And both of these groups fight for their souls. And it's amazing we keep as many as we do, because these the smart aleck objections to AA sound better to a sick mind than what we have to offer. But it's that way all over the world. And as a result of that, little by little, in doing, surrendering to these things, you start to take actions. But it's hard to surrender to these things unless you really can believe that they are apply to you. And eventually I got a job that I held when I was 2 years sober. finally was able to hold a job, a writing job finally, in a little big medical corporation. But I still didn't have any front teeth, but I learned to carry my lip like this. Nobody knew, they thought I'd been burned in a fire. And I went to work every day. And that's something my sponsor insisted on. And on those next couple of years, I learned some great spiritual lessons. And if you're new, do you want to hear some great spiritual lessons, even if you're not new? You think, what are the spiritual manifestations of AA? Oh, there's prayer, meditation. That's right. But let me give you some other big ones. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Waiters and waitresses, children, employees. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that stinking mouth, because you can cut people to ribbons and never even understand what hell happened. But I stayed on that job, and I went to work every day, and eventually, when I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. I had front teeth then. I smiled. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas. Leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody bought me a metronome. Then I got the rhythm system a little bit better. And it sure beats coitus interruptus, or whatever the hell they call it. And that makes you tense. All my kids have grown up. 3 of my daughters turned 11 this year in AA. They all came in together. The oldest one went in, the other two. And I got a bunch of kids who aren't in AA because they're not alcoholics. And live out in the west side of town. Only one of my kids has turned out bad. She's become a district attorney. We had so hoped she'd be a public defender, but no. She was home for Christmas a couple years ago, and she said, remember, Dad, when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room? I said, sure, Mary. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I have no business in Albuquerque. Why would I go there, you know? So it's all very nice. And so this is a nice story, and I live in a house by the west. And I want to say one thing. When I was 50, I've always had a little trouble making career choices. When I was 15 years sober, I was doing very well. Things were going well. And I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 27 years, I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people said, well, no, take up a love offering. Help us stay on the air. Anyway, it's not that kind of a mission. But people said, why would you give up your career in Beverly Hills to run that damn mission on Skid Row? And I've never been able to think of a good answer. I think, well, it's such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. I want to tell you something. The most important thing of all these years that took place, I'm going to say it quickly, and that is, how could all... I said tonight, I got up here, I said I was an alcoholic. How could I be an alcoholic? My problem is not really alcohol. It is when I'm drunk, but my problem, I got problems a lot worse than alcohol. I'll tell you how I overcame that, and if you're new, I want you to, if you heard nothing else tonight, listen to this. I always used to talk a lot in discussion meetings when my sponsor wasn't around, but he seemed to have a snitch in every damn meeting there ever was. But they're talking about the first step of the meeting, one step me. I can't take the first step because I'm not really an alcoholic. My problem is not alcohol. So I mean, A is a very nice thing, and I'll come here for a while, but I'm not really an alcoholic. And of course, one of his lousy snitches told him that. And he had a couple other guys over the next couple of weeks filled me some information, which I'm going to try to give you in 2 minutes. He took me 2 weeks to give me. Is this. It wound up generally like this. He said, kid, where in the first step does it say you have to be an alcoholic? I said, all over. Are you kidding? He says, why don't you read the black parts on the page? Try that. See what that looks like. Oh, yes, I remember that. He says, what does it say? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Are you powerless over alcohol? No, I'm not. Sometimes. He says, that doesn't mean that every time you drink, you go out and rape nuns and act crazy and all these dumb things. It means you've lost the power to absolutely predict what's going to happen after you start drinking. Are you going to have two or three drinks and go home? Are you going to have two or three drinks and go to a different bar? Are you going to have two or three drinks and pick up a girl? What are you going to do? Did that happen to you? I said, yes, but it wasn't my fault. You don't have to admit it's your fault. All you have to admit is you're having some problem with drinking. Are you having some problem with drinking? You know, it'd be very unlikely if you weren't. Yes, I am a little bit, kind of think about it. He said, if you're not, what the hell are you doing in AA? A non-drinker coming to AA is like a virgin going to take a pregnancy test, you know. There's no reason to think so, doctor, but let's try that old rabbit test one time. And then she comes back a week later and he says, I have some wonderful news for you, Mrs. Brown. She says, I'm Miss Brown. I have some bad news for you, Miss Brown. You're pregnant. But it can't be, doctor. I've never been touched. He says, I can't help it. The rabbit died. You're pregnant. Oh, doctor, what kind of a girl do you think I am? So he finally walks over to the window and looks out the window. She says, what are you doing that for? He says, the last time this happened, there was a star in the east. I don't want to miss it. There's that much problem. People don't come here unless they got a drinking problem. They shouldn't. So you don't have to admit you're the world's worst alcoholic every time you drank. In fact, a lot of times when you're young, drinking, I used to handle it a lot. You know, it's like playing Russian roulette with one bullet in there. Click. Ha ha. Fun last night. Click. Ha 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 ha. Click. Shit. Boom. Jesus. I'm going to stay out of Louis' place. That's a bad place. But as the years go by, some sinister force puts more and more shells in that baby. And you wind up, boom, boom, boom. There's a click in there somewhere. Boom, boom. All you got to admit, you're having some trouble drinking. I said, but that is the reason my life was screwed up. He says, it doesn't say that. He said, you say you were a writer? Read it. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. In the English language, dash means end of thought, beginning with new thought. And you're also going to admit that your life is screwed up. Is that true? Yes, but it's not my fault. Don't care whose fault it is. Is your life screwed up or not? Now stop and think about it. If either one of these forces weren't there, you wouldn't be here. If you could drink and get away with it, you'd be out drinking. If you could stop drinking without feeling so terribly bad it made you drink again, you'd be out doing that. But it's only when you get to a point where you can't stay sober and now you can't drink. And you're screwed. And there's a name for that problem. Admit these two things. You know what you've said, I'm an alcoholic, because that's what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is not a person whose problem is alcohol. An alcoholic is a person whose problem is alcoholism, which sounds the same, but it's much different. Alcohol problem can be gotten over by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In alcoholism, you'll find stopping drinking and cleaning up your act significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's why people like us must always drink again. And that's the other aspect of being an alcoholic. You must be one of the 7 or 8% of people who drink who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. So what's that natural reaction? Hardly everybody knows because you have nothing to compare it against. It's like somebody giving you a strawberry. What does that taste like? It tastes like a strawberry. You don't know if it's natural or unnatural. What is this unnatural effect? Makes you stay drunk all the time? Nah. No human body can stay drunk 2 straight weeks. Makes you act. Some people do, some people don't. It almost cost me my life. And I hope you never forget it. The problem in alcoholism, the unnatural effect, is not what it does at all. It has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people.